This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year began with women's marches across the country in response to Donald Trump's inauguration. Those marches are about to take place again, and we'll hear about them later in the hour. 2017 ended with the exploding Me Too movement, which shows no signs of letting up. Me Too came about in part as a response to a New York Times story about sexual harassment on the part of one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein. The movement has had a seismic impact on the entertainment and media industries and continues to reverberate. To help guide its coverage of this ongoing story and the growing power and influence of women, The Times created the position of gender editor, a first-of-its-kind job at the paper and one held by our first guest this hour, Jessica Bennett. She's also the author of Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace, and writes the Me Too Moment newsletter for The Times. She joins us by phone from her desk at the New York Times in Manhattan. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
You are, as I said, the first ever gender editor for The Times and probably for any newspaper in the entire world. What is your role? What does the gender editor do?
A lot of things, but essentially my goal is to better engage women readers around the world. And so what that means is doing that through journalism, through extensive coverage. It also means thinking about new platforms, thinking about ways women consume that may be differently from men. And, of course, in this particular moment, guiding and steering a lot of the sexual harassment coverage that we're continuing to do.
What are you finding about? Because newspapers have been traditionally written, published, edited by men, and if I'm not mistaken, the vast majority of readers have usually been men, although I'm sure that is changing. What is the difference in the way women view the world, write about it, read about it?
Well, you know, I think that quite naturally, if you have a product that, you know, since its existence has been created essentially by and for white men, it speaks in a way that is inherently male, which is not to say that women cannot consume it. But we've heard feedback from readers that, you know, the Times does seem very male. When they think of the New York Times, they often think of it as a man. And so we have plenty of wonderful, impressive female reporters here doing amazing investigative work, and in fact have launched this current moment and this Me Too moment that we're in. So some of this is putting them out forward. Some of this is doing research into what our readers want. Some of it is just simply doing the things we've long done, you know, rigorous coverage of topics like business and sports and international affairs, but incorporating a gender lens into that. So it's not that we're going to have a separate section. We're not trying to recreate the women's pages of the 1950s. This is simply thinking about ways that we can incorporate gender into the coverage we already do.
Are the guys who run the place having a lot of aha moments as a result of this, where they slap themselves off the side of the head because they never realized how male-centric they were and you bring it to their attention?
No, I think that they did realize we're dealing with a very woke bunch here. But certainly I think all of us could do by reminding ourselves at some times that, you know, there is an engagement gap when it comes to readership across all media. It tends to be that men have historically been the ones doing the journalism. And so not only do we want to correct for that, but we want to keep doing innovative journalism that expands on some of these themes like gender issues, like sexual harassment, like women in power, also race and sexuality and gender identity, some of these newer themes, and continue to bring readers into them.
I made an assumption at the beginning of this that you were the first ever, you are the first ever gender editor, but you may be the only one in the world. Is that the case, or have other newspapers and media outlets taken note of this and found people like you to fill a similar role at their workplace?
You know, I'm not sure. I know that I'm the first gender editor here, and there are a variety of publications that have approached this in different ways. You know, I think the realization is that no business in this day and age can thrive without engaging women. They're, in this country, 51% of the population. Globally, they hold trillions of dollars in consumer spending power. Like, simply, it's a business decision in many ways. But I think that places have approached that in different ways. Some have specifically gone after women readers by creating women-focused products. And I think that's a completely valid approach. We decided not to do that. We wanted to incorporate this coverage into what we already do, into the larger report.
You were the selection of the Times in a field of 300 applicants. They chose you. Does that put a lot of pressure on you to properly shape this conversation or guide this conversation to make sure that multiple voices are heard? I mean, you go to work every day carrying that weight around with you.
You know, I think it's sort of like any other job. I want to do my best. I've been covering these issues for a long time. This is very important to me. I care a lot about it. And quite honestly, there couldn't be a better time to be taking on this role. We recently got something like 13,000 candidates for a travel position, a staff writer that will travel around the globe for one of our travel features. So compared to that, it's actually nothing.
I was going to ask you if that job's still open.
Unfortunately, no. I kind of want it.
You wrote your book, The Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace, before a lot of people had even heard of the Me Too movement, and perhaps before it even started. And that movement, of course, let people in on a dirty little secret that a lot of women already knew because they experienced it. Your book's been published in 7 languages. It's become a podcast. It's been adapted for TV, or it's being adapted for TV. Given that, the column you write, the strength and impact of the Me Too movement and the women's marches, which we'll talk about later in this program, how did we reach suddenly, it seems like all of a sudden in the last 365 days, we reached this watershed moment?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My book came out in 2016, before the election, when I, like a lot of people, incorrectly thought that we were going to have a female president. And so it simultaneously feels more relevant and more outdated now than ever. And a lot of things in the book have had to be updated. But, you know, I think this is a long time coming. This Me Too moment or movement is a culmination of what women have been saying quietly behind closed doors through whispered networks to each other for years and years and years. And suddenly, there were women willing to speak up and break through. They happened to be very famous women, and it galvanized a movement. You know, this is something that the creator of the Me Too hashtag, a woman named Tarana Burke, an activist, had been talking about for years, but it didn't really catch on until now. And so I think that that's a combination of where we are in this moment in time politically. I think it's a combination of the way that the women's marches did galvanize women. I think it's the product of social media being able to elevate these voices and elevate voices that didn't traditionally have access to mainstream media. And so I think it's just sort of exploded from there with a lot of historical forces playing into it.
Because it didn't happen during Anita Hill's testimony before Congress about Clarence Thomas. It didn't happen with Paula Jones. It didn't happen with Monica Lewinsky. It's happening now. Is social media the biggest force here, you think?
It's a very big one. You know, it's fascinating. I was looking back at the Anita Hill case, or the Clarence Thomas case, perhaps I should refer to it as. And, you know, after that happened, people were, of course, talking about it. There were slogans and buttons that said, "I believe Anita." Complaints to the EEOC, the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, went up 73% in the year after. So it did feel, I think, at that moment, and I was too young to remember it, but I've talked to a lot of people about this now, that something was going to change. But then it didn't. You know, he got confirmed. Anita Hill kind of went quietly away for some time, and women stopped talking about it. It sort of showed women, I think, that what Anita Hill went through in the questioning and the way that she was portrayed is what any woman who dared to speak out would have to endure.
And yeah, I think I'm sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I think what's changed now is that no one woman feels like they have to bear the burden of speaking up. There is this army of women behind them and an equally extensive army using a hashtag on the internet.
Yeah, she became the bad guy during no one believed her, or the men, particularly in Congress, didn't want to believe her, or chose not to believe, or tried to paint her with very broad brushes that were not very flattering. Things have changed. However, let me flip this coin on its side. Some people look at what's happened as a result of the Me Too movement, and they see that they view it with some suspicion or some fear. A lot of people have been accused, and a lot of people have suffered severe consequences, as though they had been proven guilty, yet they did not have access to due process. A lot of these people are absolutely guilty, but some of them may or may not be. So do you believe that everyone who has been accused is guilty?
I think that there is a shift in the conversation happening right now to really looking at the nuances of, does the punishment fit the crime? And in some case, not crime in some of these cases, in some case, accusations. And I'm happy to see that we're having a more robust conversation about that, because it's incredibly important. And if you care about women being comfortable speaking up and change happening, we have to have due process. That simply is a tenet of what we stand for in this country. So I think that people are having that conversation. I've heard, I was just speaking with a legal scholar who was telling me that in some academic circles, there's conversations about, well, should there be a new term created? You know, we have manslaughter in the legal world when dealing with death. Should we have something, maybe rape slaughter is not the right word, that sounds very crass, but some sort of term that applies to some of these accusations that don't amount to sexual assault in the eyes of the law.
The other thing that we've seen movie stars plummet and directors plummet, producers' careers ended. We've seen a U.S. senator resign, a member of the House has resigned. Yesterday, a local eye doctor accused of sexual misconduct turned his license into practice and declared bankruptcy here in Charlotte. Is the ending of a career always the proper end result of these accusations?
I think that organizations are really grappling with that. You know, not all of these accusations are the same. There is a very big difference between Harvey Weinstein and a lot of these other cases. And yet, so far, there seems to be one major punishment. You lose your job and you lose your career. I think it will be interesting to watch how the rehabilitation process goes. You know, what happens to some of these people? Is their career ruined or can they come back? You know, Louis C.K. has kind of quietly now gone away, said he's gone into rehab or whatever. But will he come back? Will he be able to come back? So I'm watching that very closely. I'm very interested in it. I think there is also a real robust conversation being had about levels of punishment and how we can ensure that there is not simply one punishment for every single crime.
I would imagine that most people would agree, and women, I don't want to put women's words in women's mouths, but I would think that they would want the punishment to fit whatever the aggression was. I don't want to call it a crime because it may not be a crime, but there are various levels of this aggression, and some of them are more egregious than others. So you're saying that they might, at some future point when the pendulum begins to swing and the heat's turned down a bit, be open to some other form of discretionary punishment.
I think we're probably already seeing that happening in some organizations. You know, we're only hearing about these very public cases, and probably in those instances, organizations feel a lot of public pressure to do something rash or to come up with a very severe punishment. But I think that a lot of organizations are probably dealing with these things quietly and perhaps not simply going with the cutting off of at the knees approach. You know, there is a spectrum to this behavior. I think that part of what we're seeing with so many people coming forward and so many men falling is just how widespread this problem was, just how long it was kept quiet, just how uncomfortable women were speaking up about it. But I also think we're seeing a lot of conversation about exactly how we deal with this. And frankly, our culture is not necessarily prepared. We don't really have institutions in place to deal with a lot of this behavior.
Let me stop you because we have to take a break, Jessica. We'll come back with more with Jessica Bennett in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, talking to Jessica Bennett, the gender editor for the New York Times and the author of Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace, about the Me Too movement and other things. A lot of the results that we've seen come out of the Me Too movement have dealt with very famous people on both sides, accusers and people supporting accusers and the people who are being accused. Is anything similar to that happening in places that are not quite as public or not quite as visible?
I think we're having a lot of conversations behind closed doors still, and I think they need to come to the surface.
Because a lot of these women in Hollywood, now the Time's Up campaign formed to provide $14 million in legal defense funds for working class women. Mm-hmm. Is that the next wave? Has any of that money been put to work, or do you know?
I'm not sure how or if it's been put to work yet, but I know that it is being donated to the National Women's Law Center, which has been around for a long time. And so I saw that as a really positive sign of, you know, taking this very palpable celebrity power, this star power, and putting it into action. Because, yes, you know, wearing a black dress on the red carpet is one thing, but putting millions of dollars into a legal defense fund for working class women who don't have the same access is an entirely another one, and I think very encouraging.
We're going to talk in a few minutes about the march on Washington in last year and the one coming up in Charlotte this year, but that march was precipitated by the election of Donald Trump, and there are many reasons that Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, and well, much of that was in reaction to President Obama being the first African-American president and some other things going on in society. But at the same time, we've seen the rise in the power of women and influence of women, and women not taking it anymore, not sitting down and taking it anymore. We've seen gay people living and working openly in society, demanding their rights, including the right to marry. Transgender people have come out of the shadows. We've witnessed the Black Lives Matter movement taking place. All these things, are these all parts of a whole that is simply changing? Is this a genie that cannot be put back into the bottle?
I mean, I think so. I think that, you know, this past year has exposed a lot of things that have been simmering underneath the surface for a really long time, and also some things that we have known about and haven't properly grappled with. And so I don't know if you can put that back in, and frankly, I don't think we should.
So what are you hearing from your readers? I know you have to go, but what are you hearing from your readers about your impact on the coverage that they're seeing in the Times and the newsletter that you've written, that you write for the Times, et cetera?
You know, it's actually been fascinating. So I'm one person, and I'm pretty new here. I'm still trying to get the lay of the land, and I'm getting literally thousands of emails every week from people with all sorts of opinions. You know, there are people who disagree with the movement. There are many who have very nuanced takes on what could be an effective way to stop it. I've talked to some about bystander intervention, which is one of the few really proven things that works when it comes to sexual harassment at work. But by and large, what I am hearing is just stories, story after story after story from women and men, too, who've experienced some kind of abuse at work, who have never told anyone about it, who may not be contacting me because they want me to write about it. They simply want a place to share this. And for so long, I think so much of this has been buried. And so one of the biggest things and the most powerful things I think about this movement is that it has allowed people to speak up, oftentimes for the first time.
And is there a running theme through most of these people's stories that they share with you?
You know, it's a power differential. A lot of it has to do with power. People who are in positions where they didn't feel like they could speak up, where they felt like they had to take it because this person held their job in their hands. And in many cases, not people with economic or media power to, you know, expose the behavior. So people that really have not spoken out about it. And I think it's really important. I think that one way this coverage is now shifting, and I'm happy to see it, is that we are focusing less on the celebrities and more on regular women who endure this every day. And I think that is important.
Jessica Bennett is the gender editor, the first ever gender editor of the New York Times, the writer of their Me Too Moment newsletter, and the author of Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace. I wish I had more time with you. I'd ask you if that came out of your personal experience, but I know you have to run off to a meeting. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're very welcome. The women's marches that took place last year on the day after Inauguration Day didn't just take place in Washington. That's the sound of Charlotte's march. And women's marches occurred all over the world. They ended up being the largest ever single-day protest in American history. Women in the Me Too movement have very specific reasons for taking part. Women involved in the march, as well as the men who marched, had a variety of concerns.
child or job, we should not have to choose.
Love, not hate, makes America great.
Women's rights are human rights.
I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I'm changing the things I cannot accept.
Standing with Planned Parenthood, climate change.
I choose hope over fear.
This is America, so fight like you got a pair of ovaries.
The voices of those who marched in Charlotte last year. Those marches energized women, even those who didn't take part. But some wondered about their lasting impact. Did they signal the beginning of a new women's movement? What have those who marched been doing since that day? What is next? We're going to find out. The women's marches were not a one and done. In fact, there's another scheduled in Charlotte for this Saturday. And we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking with three women who were part of the marches last January and who will be taking part in this weekend's march. Jan Anderson is president and coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March, a retired civil engineer. She helped organize a bus trip to last year's march in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Kelly Finley is a senior lecturer in women's and gender studies at UNC Charlotte and is founder and executive director of Girls Rock Charlotte. You've been scribbling notes furiously during the first part of the program. Welcome back to you as well.
It's a great conversation. Thank you.
She participated in last year's Charlotte March, is on the planning committee for this year's March, and Allison Jacobs is part of the bus tour that went to D.C. in 2017. Since then, she's been active in the Social Justice Committee of the Charlotte Women's March, and she's also a principal consultant of ROI Impact Consulting and currently serves as a WFAE board member. We say that in the interest of full disclosure. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Women came out in force last January. There were it looked like every woman in America was marching in Washington, D.C. and around the country. By the end of the year, women were having a different impact on the world. And from the conversations that you've had among other women, either at the march last year or in the year that has come, the years that preceded the march or in the year that has followed that march, could you have predicted the impact that women are currently having on society today? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of. Everybody's pointing to Kelly and to Jan. So, Kelly, I'll start with you. Jan, I'll go to you. Kelly.
I think you could have predicted this. You know, there was a groundswell after the election, the big surprise election, and a lot of fear, a lot of concern. And, I was fortunate enough to be here in that Charlotte moment and the Charlotte March. And, there were a lot of parents, a lot of families, a lot of community members who wanted to, you know, make it known in Charlotte, make it known to our community and to our nation that, we stand in solidarity, that there is always hope and power in the people. And so I definitely think it was easily predictable, especially if you understand history. And I think it was interesting when you asked Jessica earlier, when you talk about the various different social movements that are happening all in concert with one another today, that's happened in the past. And we know well what has happened as a result of those coming out of, for example, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the major political and cultural shifts that took place. And I definitely think, with my academic hat on, that we are poised at that moment yet again.
There's always a pushback to change because people don't like change.
The backlash.
Is that pushback, are you seeing it, first of all? Is the pushback coming from people who don't want to lose power or give up power or share power, or is there something else at work here?
No, by definition, that is what backlash is. It's a disproportionate reaction, you know, when someone is trying to take what you perceive to be what you are entitled to, your power, your privilege. And I definitely think that could be, you know, encapsulated in what happened in 2017, and we have seen it in the past with history, when it comes to racism, sexism, homophobia, and so forth. So, you know, from a long view of history, you know, backlash and movements can be quite predictable, but when you're sitting in the storm of them in the moment, they feel like, you know, lightning in a bottle.
So, Jan, when you were on this program last year, right after the march, you said that the Women's March on Washington was a beginning. Were you right?
For the Charlotte Women's March, it certainly was. We had a meeting right after the march. There were 45 women on my bus. I thought that would be the size of the meeting. 250 women showed up. We had a membership of 600 for most of last year, and in the last month, we've tripled that with interest in the march this year. Mm. We are certainly woke, and we certainly are not where we want to be yet. And the Charlotte Women's March has changed from a march to a movement by all of the activities we did this past year. We weren't just sitting around waiting for the next march. We've formed 8 interest groups, and we've been actively working for change in our community.
And you're on the Social Justice Committee, Rosalind, and I'm wondering how you see the Me Too movement. The year began with the march. It's kind of come to, the 2017 came to an end with Me Too being in the spotlight. Is that the natural outgrowth of these marches? Is that something that you concentrate on in the social justice area?
Well, so the racial and social justice is much more, it's more broad-based than Me Too. Mm-hmm. It really focused on, so I think we have to take into consideration the events that preceded the election here and how this community, the awareness here about racial injustice was heightened. I think that sort of laid the groundwork for the events and the way that the Charlotte Women's March organization evolved into the separate group. So I would say that the social justice is as much focused on racial justice in this community as anything else.
And one of the criticisms that has been levied at these marches last year, the March on Washington and perhaps even in Charlotte and elsewhere around the country, was that women of color didn't participate to the degree that white women did. And was that because they didn't feel welcome, because they're not connected as together as well as white women are? Is it a social capital thing? What was going on there? Because this affects them, obviously, too.
So there are a couple of things. I'll say that I attended the D.C. March. I got the last seat on the bus with Jan. I was very fortunate. I did not attend the Charlotte March. My observation, my experience from D.C. was that it was very well attended by women of color.
Okay.
Moreover, I was impressed by the cross-pollination of issues. So I saw lots of white men and women carrying Black Lives Matter signs and chanting Black Lives Matter. So I think that, again, I don't know what happened here, but my experience there was something different. I will say historically, your first guest talked about, you guys talked about the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas issue. I would offer that it was a bit more nuanced than that. I would say that if Anita Hill had been a white woman with Clarence Thomas as a black man, I think the outcome of that would have been quite different. And so, historically, there has been a schism between women of color and white women in the women's movement.
You told WFAE's David Borax that you saw Trump's election as, quote, an affront on women, and women were not going to give up their hard-earned progress. That was the undercurrent of all the marches, I believe, around the country. Has that resolve held through the year? Has it grown in any way?
Well, that comes from me being a retired engineer with 40 years in the business. And so when Kelly speaks, I feel like I am the history she's talking about. I was in college in the 60s with all of the movements, the Women's Lib movement, the Civil Rights movement, the Vietnam War movement. We were moving on everything back then, I think.
And now we can barely move.
We gained some rights back then, and then those women of my generation got jobs, hunkered down, and did our best to advance. And the women on our bus were a lot of women who were senior in their jobs and retired successfully from careers. We felt like we had worked hard to get where we are, and we were not giving up those rights. Now, what that also means is that we haven't gotten as far as we want to be. And the benefit of what's happening now is that we can have a conversation out loud about this. Mm-hmm. Because in the past, going back to the Anita Hill thing and stuff, I think what happened with that whole thing was once it was over, people stopped listening to the conversation, and people were generally men in leadership roles. Women were still having that conversation, but quietly, because we were told it didn't matter what happened to us, because it would be ignored. Now it's not going to be ignored anymore.
You talked about the fear that surrounded, that was kind of an undercurrent at the marches, among the participants in the marches, Kelly. What were those fears, and were they justified? This was in anticipation of what President Trump might accomplish as having run as a candidate and been elected. Were they justified?
Absolutely. I mean, we have on record a presidential candidate at the time who is now president who verbally spoke of sexually assaulting. That's not necessarily the correct term, but sexually harassing women. And so those words to come through the airwaves to all the parents and mothers to girls in this nation strikes fear and anger and resolve. And so it was very real. It's very palpable. But also think of, so when we talk about it from a gender lens, you have that very real fear that I definitely think that helped to inflame the Me Too and Time's Up movement. But also look at, you know, DACA issues, immigration issues, racism and LGBTQ that we were coming out of as well. And everything that his platform stood poised to undo. There was definite real fear, but there was also resolve. And I think that's, you know, very important to understand. It's resolve that absolutely not. You know, you heard people from 3 to, you know, 80 to 85 that day in strollers and everything going down the streets here of Charlotte with some pretty interesting language I probably can't share on the radio right now, that they're not going back.
Only the president can say things like that. So you said that a lot of the people, and this is true, if you look at the crowd at all these marches, a lot of the people that came out had never done this before. They were not rabble-rousers. They were not people who picked up signs and protested ever in their lives. You said that this event changed them in some way. How?
Definitely. Well, you know, I think about many of us heard Oprah speak on, you know, the Golden Globes, and she talked about, you know, when she addressed girls directly to the lens, a new dawn is coming. But that dawn doesn't arrive without work and effort and engagement. And so what we saw this past time, this past March, what we're going to do again this coming Saturday is that engagement. And that's what, you know, when it comes to, you think about the power of youth, it's the power of a voice, but it's also action together. And you need to bring those two together. And a march is just one way, one powerful and important way to make that happen.
We only have a couple of seconds left in this segment, but how many people are you expecting for this march? And the weather will be nice for this march on Saturday. How many people are you expecting?
Well, we definitely think there will be at least 5,000 people marching, women and men and children. Please come out. And it could be much, much larger, especially since the weather's going to be good.
Yes, it's going to be in the mid-50s with sunshine. We're going to come back and talk more about this movement, these marches, etc., when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Women's March from last year and the one coming up in Charlotte on Saturday. It begins Saturday at First Ward Park at 10 o'clock with speeches in the park, and then the march proceeds at noon. The people some of the people responsible for that are sitting around this table. Jan Anderson is the president and coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March. Kelly Finley, senior lecturer in women's and gender studies at UNC Charlotte, the founder of Girls Rock Charlotte, and Rosalind Allison Jacobs on the Social Justice Committee of the Women's March in Charlotte and a member of the board here at WFAE. We have some emails that came in from people. Autumn emailed us some reasons why she is marching. Affordable access to birth control, equal pay, affordable child care, and the ability to go to work and not be sexually harassed are all issues that are important to me, she says. Just like last year, my husband, myself, and our girls will be marching for our community, for our sisters, and for our girls' futures. Sheila emails, born in the 50s, I grew up watching protests for justice, civil rights, women's rights, and change in general. Last year when I joined my fellow sisters, it was the most moving and powerful experience of my life. Walking with women of all ages and all races was inspirational. We were there out of love for each other and love of country. There were young girls who participated and witnessed their mothers and their grandmothers standing and speaking truth to power. I was going to ask the three of you what that march meant to you and what this weekend's march means to you. Jan, I'll start with you.
It was the way I could get out of bed in the morning after the November elections. I went to Washington, and the march in Washington was a way for me to get energized to come back and act, which is why we formed the Women's March Group here, so that we can work throughout this year to affect change. And in 2018, our goal is to get both women and men elected to office who are like-minded and who will pass and enact legislation that supports those issues that women find important.
Rosalyn.
For me, it was my patriotic obligation. I felt that it was my duty to show up that what happened was not acceptable. The results of the election do not represent America. And I, at my core, I needed to physically be with people. I needed some reassurance that there were still people who could not go along with the results of the election.
Kelly?
Well, I was really tempted to go to D.C., and I really wanted to, but because I am one of the leaders of a youth organization, I thought it was important to stay here in our community, and it was powerful to march with our youth, with my own daughter. When you interviewed Jessica earlier, she talked about that there is a power differential, and I think it's important for, you know, us to remember that our girls in many groups are raised in this country and in this world not knowing or experiencing their power. So to be able to do that together, you know, as a parent, as a community leader, as an educator, was critical. It is that next thing, you know, once you use your voice, now you have to act. And marching is one of those most powerful, memorable ways to do so.
The reason behind the march last year was to, protest what you saw as the impending shift in position that would be coming in with the Trump administration. And say we're not going to allow this to happen if we can stop it. What is the reason behind this march this year? Is it the same thing? Is it reaction to policies that Trump has actually followed through on? Has he been as onerous as you thought he would be, and that's why we have to have yet a second march?
Before Jan answers, I just want to say that the tone that was set on the bus by Jan and others from the outset was, we are going to Washington to march for what we believe in. This is not an anti-Trump march for us. This is going to advocate for what we are for. Jan?
Do you need to add to that? You may not need to add to that.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Very important. No, the other thing I would just say is what I'm seeing this year now with the response we've gotten for the march is this is no longer about Trump. This is bigger than Trump. This is about social change and respect and dignity for women.
Okay. Because I asked, when two of you were on this program, I mean, Kelly and Jan, you were here last year on this program, if the women and men who marched on Washington and on Charlotte and around the country, if they were all liberals, if you found any conservatives in your midst, what was the makeup of that crowd? What do you anticipate the makeup of the crowd will be this time?
A lot of women's issues go beyond political boundaries, that's for sure. And starting with birth control, if you want to start with one that's obvious, I don't know of any women out there who are anti-birth control. There are a few, but not many. That's something that goes across lines. Dignity, equality, respect are terms that go beyond any kind of political system whatsoever.
Because Mary emails, pro-life women are not welcome at this event, so it would be more appropriate to call it the Pro-Choice Women's March. What do you say to that?
I'd like to answer that because I've gotten an email similar. It might have been from the same person. We welcome all women of all persuasions as long as you respect other people's opinions. We are not pro or anti anything. We respect everyone for what they believe in.
This may answer Amy's email, too. I did not participate, she said, in the Women's March last year. Many marchers used it as an anti-Trump rally just to exclaim their distaste for him. I'm all for women having equal treatment. We should have equal pay and feel safe from sexual harassment. However, I'm also pro-life and would not want my marching to be confused for supporting abortion in any way. It would be nice to have a women's march that could still show love and support for women's issues without being extreme left or right in order to include all women. Is that possible, given the genesis of these marches?
We have members who are pro-life. I know of a few friends of mine in particular that I know where they stand on those issues, but they feel like the greater issues are for women's equality. And we can stand together as long as we respect one another, mm-hmm. as well as one another's issues.
Can that message get out, or is it still just too connected to Donald Trump and the reason it's it sprang from Donald Trump last year, and therefore people just see that in it automatically.
No, I think that message is getting out because we're seeing just this past week some horrible research and data that's coming through on maternal mortality rates in the United States, and it's disproportionately affecting rural women and women of color, meaning mothers are dying still in birth here in the United States. So when we talk about, you know, pro-life or, you know, and all this language, it's a vast oversimplification of a huge umbrella that affects all, which is women's health and access to comprehensive women's health care for all women and all genders in the United States. So, you know, if someone feels one way or the other on a particular issue, mm-hmm. we cannot reduce, you know, a woman's biology to one particular issue. And that has been the mistake over decades and decades. And we're just not having those conversations anymore. It's about reproductive justice. It's about you have the right to make the decision for your overall health care at every time and every place.
Ideas are transmitted through words. Words matter. And sometimes words fail us. And one of you referenced you've been working to support what you call, quote, like-minded individuals, end quote. What does that mean to you? Because it might mean something different to the listener.
So who's going to show up on Saturday? This is related to your question. I would hope that it would be some men and women voters who now have buyer's remorse. So for me, like-minded means that the direction, the tone, the tenor, the vulgarity, the way that our democracy is being undermined and has devolved under this administration is not acceptable. And I would hope that we could find common ground over the direction that we want our country to take, regardless of what you feel about pro-choice, pro-life, birth control. Can we not find common ground about basic decency, respect for human life, and come together around that?
You're nonpartisan. I want to make that clear. You're nonpartisan, but you are speaking your minds to office holders and office seekers, and you are supporting candidates. Am I correct in that? So if you're supporting candidates, are you supporting Democratic candidates? Are you supporting Republican candidates? Are you supporting Libertarian? Are you supporting people simply based on their background, their experience, their ideas? Who are you supporting?
Okay, let me be clear. The Charlotte Women's March will support candidates who support our values. We do not endorse candidates, and we recommend that our membership find and support their candidates of their choice. And we have had candidates of many persuasions, several persuasions, I should say, so far, who are part of our group and have actually been elected to office.
And are they Republicans, some of them?
I know, yeah.
They are? You sound a little iffy on that.
But. Well, I know one, so... We only have a few who've actually run and been elected so far because we've only been around for a year.
Well, according to the Rutgers Center for American Women in Politics, the number of potential women candidates for the U.S. House this year, 2018, is double that of 2012. 161 in 2012, 354 candidates so far in 2018. Can you give any credit to the awakening that occurred because of the women's marches last year, or do you attribute this rise in the number of female candidates to something else?
No, I absolutely think it's, you know, in great part to the 2017 march. And I've heard some people say the theme for 2018 is power to the polls. Whoever you're electing is your choice, obviously. But, you know, and to speak to Rosalind's point, we need to turn up the volume on civic engagement in this culture again. We need to defend democracy in this culture again and engage our democracy. You know, when we have looked at voter turnout numbers across different generations and populations, they've been pathetically sad and disheartening until this past year. We have seen, you know, entire precincts and states even, you know, completely flip polls. So I think it's something to think about when you're seeing all these women engage their democracy. You know, I'm not really as concerned as to what their political party is. I'm just glad to see more people and more voices and more identities in the mix. It's critical to the future of our democracy.
Despite the criticism by some that the marches last year were particularly lily white women, and you already said, Rosalind, that was not true. That was not your experience. Kelly, you say you saw a new ethic of inclusion in last year's march. Why do we have this criticism on the one side, and for those who participated, and observed carefully, they didn't see the same thing.
Well, there is definitely. I mean, I know historically, as Rosalind mentioned, there have been schisms within women's movement and social justice when it comes to racism and sexism and homophobia. But in 2017, time's up on that, you know, lie. If you look at the young women who, in particular, led and, you know, started the push for the 2017 Women's March, you know, they, with intent and purpose, were one of the most diverse, inclusive groups I've ever seen on a platform before. We have learned the lessons of the past historically, and honestly, it is a lot of young women and women of color and transgendered issues and immigrants and so forth and undocumented individuals who are leading this cause, and that's exactly how it should be. So I think anyone who is still having that call perhaps are hearkening back to the 70s and 80s when that was a rightful critique of the feminist movement, but that's not where we are now. Anybody who's woke about feminism knows that that is not where we are right now.
Well, the marches last year and the march this Saturday in Charlotte are billed as women's marches, but you're talking about a lot of different issues here. You've referenced LGBTQ issues. You've referenced, transgender is part of that. You've referenced other things. I would think Black Lives Matter comes into this. So is the name Women's March accurate? Or is it limiting?
Women's rights are human rights. They're everybody. And everybody has at least one woman in their lives, their mother. They've got sisters and daughters and cousins and parents and grandparents. So women's rights is just looking at things from a different perspective than traditionally, which has been a predominantly male perspective. So that's where we're coming from with this, is it's not, we're just saying, join us because we support you and your interests.
And can we not just acknowledge that women are taking the lead on organizing? That's what Charlotte Women's March means. Women are taking the lead on organizing around human rights and addressing human rights issues.
Okay. Bob in Villis, is that how you say it? I've never heard of Villis, North Carolina. He emails, the Women's March and the Me Too movement are long overdue and necessary steps to expose the exploitation of women by men in positions of power. These same men and some women have used their position of power to economically exploit millions of our fellow citizens. The promise of America cannot be realized until the contributions of women and men are equal and must be honored by our leaders. Exploitation of any kind must be confronted and stopped. Meanwhile, Aaron emails, as a 30-year-old white male who lives in one of the most red districts in the state, I feel as if I'm fighting myself to keep my eyes and ears open. I know that it's my turn to keep my mouth shut and listen at this time. A question, how in the world has gender equality become a political partisan issue? Has it become one?
If you look at the way things are playing out in Washington, D.C., I would say yes.
How so?
Well, we've got two Democratic elected officials who have resigned. We have zero Republican elected officials who have been accused of sexual misconduct have resigned. Has it become political? You tell me.
Well, they're trying to maintain their majority.
Does that not then put political parties over patriotism and defending human rights, defending rights of women?
Is Charlotte the only place having one of these, what you're calling a remarch? Are we the only city doing this weekend, this Saturday?
Oh, no. It's more or less a grassroots movement this year. The national organization, I think, has a march scheduled for Las Vegas. In North Carolina, we know there are marches in Raleigh, Winston-Salem, Charlotte, and Asheville.
Are these marches the most important? Is the most important thing to get a turnout to make a point, or is the most important thing to use this as a touchstone to keep the movement energized? And I have 10 seconds. That's all I got.
It's absolutely all about the touchstone to keep the momentum, to keep the inspiration going, and to keep the collaboration working.
Kelly Finley with UNC Charlotte and Girls Rock Charlotte, Jan Anderson, President Coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March, and Rosalind Allison Jacobs on the Social Justice Committee of the March. It's this weekend.